You're listening to a Comics XF podcast.
Matt Laswitz, and welcome to this week's episode of Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast, where each week my co-hosts Will Nevin and I dig into three Batman stories, discuss them, and rank them on the big board, thus creating a giant list of Batman stories from best to worst. So Will, how's it going tonight?
Yay, it's going pretty good, Matt. Going pretty good. I've got an update from 2 weeks ago. Remember, I came to you with my problem about how Facebook was serving me up fart videos.
Yes.
I'm happy to report all I got is dog and cat videos at the moment.
That's what you got to do. You just got to teach the algorithm.
I haven't seen a fart video in several days. And I'm feeling pretty good.
Glad to hear it. My feed has mostly been filled recently with an animal sanctuary where they take care of baby tigers, baby lions, things like that, like big cats. And it mostly is just this one baby bear who's a real jerk and keeps picking on the baby tigers because tigers tend to be solitary. You want to be left alone. And this baby bear just kind of keeps jumping on them and fucking around. And after a while, the tigers just were like, no, it's actually really adorable because nobody gets, you know, they don't get hurt and they're just kind of playing around and it's pretty adorable.
Yeah. Just reconfirming. I've got a turtle, a wild cat video, a fox, a random truck video, cat playing with a rat, something about fighting fires, guy falling through a rain cloud, and then another cat video. So yeah, again, I'm feeling pretty good about that mix.
Sounds considerably better than what you were getting before.
Yes, yes. No more farting on ring cameras. And look, if you are out there making content, you know, just farting on people's doorbells, stop doing that.
But I would absolutely say stop doing it because it's rude. But if it's your thing to watch it, I'm not yucking your yum.
All right. So it is better than Joe Rogan.
Yes.
If you have a choice in your day between watching fart videos for ring cameras and listening to Joe Rogan, by all means, go ahead and watch those fart videos.
Many fewer people were hurt by the former than the latter.
That's right. Fart video is not going to give you any anti-vaccine nonsense. It's not going to give you any ancient aliens nonsense. It's just going to make you dumber in the way that, you know, watching a fart video can.
I sometimes have stuff for this segment, but I don't because we've got a lot to talk about tonight.
We do have a lot to talk about tonight because it's a big night.
It is because tonight, our first story tonight will be the 400th story on the big
woo,
board.
Woo, 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 woo.
In my head, when we first started this, I was like, yeah, we're gonna do this forever. You know, we're gonna get all these stories on there. But you know, really 400, that's a lot of freaking Batman stories.
That's a lot of reading.
It's a lot of reading. And a lot of reading of stuff I've already read. And I haven't cheated once. I have actually reread every story that we have put on there. Some of them I probably could have cheated on. I've read Long Halloween so damn many times. And those top couple there, I've read those enough times. I probably could have done it from memory. But nope, I went in and reread them. But there's also a lot here that were first-time rereads and that handful of I'd never read them befores. I would like to try to spend a little more time in that 40s and 50s where I have not read a lot of that material, but those tend to be shorts. And so they're harder to, you know, build an episode around 3 8-page stories. That's not easy.
No. And it's hard to tie in like a theme or a current idea that would harken back to one of those stories.
You have to come up with the theme and then dig to find something that kind of works. We've got an episode coming up in a few weeks where I wound up having to do that digging. We won't spoil it for everyone, but the upcoming Patreon request from Abigail Hartbaum required me to do some digging through the Golden and Silver Age to find the third story to fit with the two that we already had. But again, with 85 years of Batman stories, you can pretty much find three to fit any theme if you look hard enough.
He's done a lot.
Yeah. And he's especially done a lot in the first story of the night. There's the segue.
Nice.
Which is, okay, and I will explain once I have given you the general rundown, everyone, of how I am naming this and where this comes from, because it's kind of ridiculous. The first story of the night is Batman Black and White, the Gotham Knights Stories, Volume 1. This is Batman Gotham Knights. Numbers 1 to 16, and the Batman Black and White Volume 2 trade paperback. This is an anthology, so we'll touch on creators as we go, but this was edited by Mike Chiarello and Valerie D'Orazio. The cover dates are March of 2000 to June of 2001 and August of 2002. Return to tales of show and substance in more black and white tales from some of comics' top creators. So, there have been three distinct Batman Black and White miniseries. They would technically be Batman Black and White volumes 1, 2, and 3, because, three miniseries makes perfect sense, right?
Sure does.
Except Batman Black and White ran as backups for the first 49 issues of the Gotham Knights ongoing. Since volumes 2 and 3 miniseries were in the future from that, Trade Volume 2 collects the first 16 of those, plus some stories that were just in that trade. Trade 3 collects 17 to 49. Then Batman Black and White Volume 4 Trade is miniseries Volume 2. And Volume 5 is miniseries Volume 3. And I assume at some point we will get a Volume 6 trade that will collect the black and white backups from Brave and the Bold.
Makes perfect sense.
It makes even my brain hurt a little. But I need to break these up because we've already done Volume 1 and Volume 3 for the big board. So I am calling this the Gotham Knights Stories Volume 1 and the next one, the Gotham Knights Stories Volume 2.
But this is Batman Black and White Volume 2,
Yes, which
which
I have
is
to.
how it's going to go down on my board.
Right. And I have to include it this way because there are the sh six, five or six shorts that were exclusive to that collection. But first up,
Actually, I don't know how I put this down, how this is on my board. So let's see. I've got Batman Black and White Volume 1 is at 10.
yes.
And
And
where's the next black and white?
the next black and white is down at, it's still fairly high, 78. That's miniseries volume 3. We've not done the second miniseries yet, nor obviously the second collection of the shorts from Gotham Knights.
And I have 78 down as Batman Black and White Volume 3, parentheses, apparently.
Yes, you could just change that to volume 5 for your list to make it clearer. I have.
Oh, God, I'm already confused.
Yes. But before we get into the stories, we've got a hat trick of problematic creators on this one.
Hey.
Three. First is Warren Ellis, noted sex creep. John Byrne, noted xenophobe and transphobe. And Howard Chaykin, noted transphobe and Islamophobe. So, three problematic guys. We have 22 8-page shorts in this collection, which is, hairless than the original Black and White, which had 30 stories, 5 stories over 6 issues. The first thing I want to say is we've seen, I think we've commented on when we talked about volume three, the later volume. I'll stop using volume numbers. And in the column about some of the stuff we've gotten in Brave and the Bold, that a lot of times now, a lot of the black and whites that we get feel like, let's give this artist their first chance to be a writer artist or some tryout material on black and white. This is not that.
No, this is Harlan Ellison. This is Chris Claremont.
This
This
is.
is your all-star dream. Hey, come on in and do a little short for us, if you please.
Right. This is lines up with volume one, where every one of these stories has at least one, if not both of these creators are legends. And the ones who aren't legends are old hands who have been working in the industry for years and are just strong creators.
God damn, it opens with Paul Dini, and we've said a whole lot about him. We're going to continue to say a whole lot about him, but it's Paul Dini with Alex Ross. Like,
Yes.
holy shit.
Yes,
That's how it opens.
the first handful are the originals to the collection. Case Study, Batsman, A Matter of Trust, Night After Night, and Fortunes. The short from the first issue of Gotham Knights is the Ellis and, oh right, Jim Lee.
Yeah, that guy.
A guy who at that point was not known for his DC work. That was an exception to the rule, getting Lee to do a DC story. It was right around the time of the Wildstorm acquisition. How do we want to handle talking about this? I mean, do we want to kind of go, talk about which ones we liked the most versus which ones didn't do it for us? So, was there a clear favorite for you?
Story-wise, as much as it pains me to say this, because he was right there in your problematic creator watch, Chaykin's Blackout. I thought that was a fun story as a period Batman 1940s. Batman fighting Gotham Nazis. Like, it was a cute story, and a couple of them got me emotionally, and I'm trying to remember which ones those were.
Blackout, by the way, is Howard Chaykin on scripts, Jordi Bernais on art. He's a European artist, did a lot of Westerns, did a large chunk of the early to mid-aughts Jonah Hex series with Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray. I will say the ones that got me, speaking of the emotional beats, and it's such a weird story in that it has zero Batman in it. It's just a Bruce Wayne story.
Oh, Claremont's.
Yeah, Claremont and Rouge, A
Oh.
Matter of Trust.
Oh my God. It's Bruce Wayne as babysitter. And yeah, it's oh, right in the feels.
It's another friend that we've never seen before and we'll probably never see again because that's what happens when you're friends with Bruce Wayne. You appear for one story.
Single doctor lady with two kids needs a babysitter. Why
And
not call Bruce Wayne?
Bruce was the godfather of her twins, so she calls him, and we're probably pretty early in the Batman of it all because there's no mention of Robins. He does mention Alfred. But so he's completely lost. And these kids are running around and they're causing chaos. They're in the bath, and one kid runs out, and Bruce kind of chases him. And then when he turns around, he hears the other kid going, "Gun, gun, gun." And he kind of goes Batman and flips and plucks the gun away. And it's a cap gun. And he realizes he scared these kids. And he's crushed because he never wanted to scare these children. And then they hug him and say, "It's okay, we'll protect you." And it's just, oh.
Yes.
And Steve Rude's art is stunning on it. I mean, he's one of those guys who in general is stunning. And latter day Claremont is not always my thing, but this story really works.
It sure does. It was touching, well-paced, silly. Boop, 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 boop. You know, that
Yes.
got a good chuckle. And just charming in all the right ways. And the story that followed that, Night After Night from Kelly Puckett and Tim Sale,
Yeah.
that was beautiful and a similar, like, oh, this is really just a core, like, Batman story. How he can't get over the night his parents were killed, but that also drives him and motivates him.
And Sale works really well in this because Sale looks gorgeous in black and white. There are some of these that particularly look good in black and white. The ones that jumped out at me specifically, and these are artists who have tended to work in black and white. Walt Simonson and Jean-Paul Leon's The Riddle, which is a Riddler story. Leon is an artist whose work is very blocky and very much about light and shadow. So he's an artist who works in black and white very well. Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso's Zaz story, Scars. Again, Risso is an artist who works in black and white.
And that was a very simple story too. So, and it worked well.
Credit to Azzarello for really getting Zaz. We talked about that last week with that Stephanie Brown story about how not every writer gets Zaz's particular mania, but this story very much does. For Zaz, it's all about connection, that the only time he ever feels connected to another person is when he is watching the life drain from their eyes and treating it with Batman as the inverse, who sees his connection when he's seeing the look in someone's eyes when he's saving them. I thought it was a nice contrast between those two characters. Credit to Dave Gibbons for absolutely working in black and white as a theme in his Black and White Bandit, which freaking reads like an episode of 66.
Oh, it absolutely does.
Up to and including a villain with a funny, punny name. Because he's Roscoe Chiara, or as you flip it around, Chiaroscuro, the art style that is about shadow and
Wah,
light.
wah.
Yep, it is so absolutely 66. It's got the set pieces, it's got the villain with the kooky motivation. It is a perfect 66 story. And Stormy Nether from Tom Pyre and Gene Colan on pencils, Palmer on inks. Again, Colan and Palmer have a history in black and white. They did, or Colan very specifically, did the Marvel Dracula magazine, the black and white magazines of the 70s, as well as the color Tomb of Dracula comic, which I read in those big black and white Marvel Essential phone books, which don't always work when they strip the color out and just ship them as big black and white collections. But Colan is an artist, again, who does so much with light and shadow that black and white really works in his style.
We've talked about the highs. I'm curious, what are your ebbs?
Well, while I liked the first Dini story fine, the second one, I literally have one note with this story called The Bet by Paul Dini and Ronnie Del Carmen. Oh Lord, Will is going to hate this. That is all I wrote.
The central idea is that Ivy and Harley have a bet that Ivy can get all of the men in the asylum to kiss her. And yeah, that's already a bad idea. And it's already a double bad idea coming from Paul Dini. But visually, it is so messy. It is hard to follow. And bleh, no, it was definitely in my bottom two.
What was the other one in your bottom two? I'm
The
curious.
other one was Batsman.
Yeah,
And just a zany parody. I don't, I, if given an opportunity to write a Batman story, I am not going to write a parody. I don't understand the thought behind that.
it absolutely read like a story in Mad.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
partially it's, I think, because Templeton has written a ton of Batman stories. So possibly for him, it was a challenge to do this. And or Marie Severin is an artist whose style lends itself more towards comedy than the serious. So when you're partnered with an artist whose style lends itself to that, you run with it. I will say there's a lot, so many Easter eggs. The whole story is just littered with little cameos and appearances. Again, I think I noted as well drawn, but not much there.
No, it is fun to look at, but it is absolutely something better left for Mad. We talked about the Dini Ross pairing, but I thought the story, and obviously Ross is, as a master of the medium. If I'm going to get Alex Ross, I really do want it to be in color. I think he's a little misplaced here, but Dini's story as, someone looking over Joker's case file. And oh, is Joker sane? Is this all a put on? Yeah, it's really fun to tease out, and then just the conclusion there of Harley walking by. It's like, oh yeah, I started that. Mr. J's the best.
And the
Chilling,
final, yeah,
chilling.
and the final resolution from the head doctor is like, you might as well burn it. I'm sure the Joker left that there for us to find, just to give us that moment of hope before it's yanked away.
Yeah.
Frankly, that works with either a sane or insane Joker. The whole thing is ambiguous.
It would be nice to see in color. It really would.
Yeah. There are two stories in here written by John Arcudi. Greetings from Gotham City with Tony Sammons on art, and A Game of Bat and Rat with John Buscema on art. And they're both perfectly fine.
I thought Greetings from Gotham City, yeah, as much as I hated Batsman, Greetings from Gotham City was a good example of how to do funny Batman.
Yeah, I like the setup. And the punchline. Neither of them, there are so many standout stories in here, and those will both go down in that the column of these are good. These are good,
Yeah.
but they're not knock me out of the park like some of these, the ones we've talked about. I think a lot of what we have left is the middle of the road, or I mean, there's a couple of ones that, like, I mean, the Ellison story, the Gene Ha art is stunning, but Ellison is clearly someone who is used to writing prose because at least the first half of that story is very overwritten. It's a lot of panels, it's a lot of word bubbles in a lot of panels, and you kind of wanted Gene Ha to be able to breathe a little more.
And two, the story is fairly complicated for 8 pages, right? It's like Batman helping the Treasury Department. These goons have stolen plates and paper, and oh, Batman has to intimidate a possible witness, but not intimidate him so much that they would have to throw out, any evidence. You're very right. Like Ellison is not working in his natural element here, but he is a good storyteller. Like it's an interesting story for
Yeah.
sure.
And I will say someday we will read the other Ellison Batman story. This is the superior of the two. I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's one of those stories that I feel like Ellison's Batman in his head is not the Batman in my head. And so the way his other Batman story ends never sat right with me.
We could also read for a bonus episode, City on the Edge of Forever.
Oh yeah, that'd be fun. I think I've got a digital copy of that somewhere. I did enjoy, but again, it falls in the category of a perfectly good Batman story. Guardian from Alan Brennert and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Brennert is To Kill a Legend and a bunch of other stuff that we haven't read yet, some really great Batman stories. And I mean, Garcia Lopez, all of the art that has you've ever seen, the Batman model that appears in all the marketing stuff with the classic gray and blue costume, that's all Garcia Lopez. He drew the model sheets for DC marketing that was used for 20 years.
Yeah, it was nice to see Alan Scott. Is that right?
Yes.
There we go. Yeah, that was an interesting character to work with, but I think the same thing with Allison. It's too talky. It's not paced quite right for 8 pages, but interesting. And the relationship that Batman and Scott developed together. So yeah, good, but not as successful as some of these other stories.
I like how it's one of only a few in here that are very much sort of entrenched in continuity, because it's very clearly a year one story, because Batman says he's never met another caped hero before. There's mentions of the Romans still being in power. Alan Scott talks about the Reaper appearing in Gotham. So it is very much Brennert playing in that post-crisis continuity. Holy Terror. That's the other Brennert we've read. Holy Terror.
The story that follows Guardian, what is that one?
Snow Job, Bob Conagher and Kyle Baker.
It does not work.
No, Conagher's another like old hand. Like, he created Sergeant Rock. He created Barry Allen.
That's just pretty old.
And he passed before the trade was released, at least, if not before his story was published. And this is very much Silver Age wacky. Kyle
But
Baker's art is Kyle Baker art, but the story itself is sort of, again, meh.
the art style is not for me. It looks like indie web comic.
Well, I mean, Baker is very indie in his style. Why I Hate Saturn, things like that. It is not traditional superhero art. It's funny, we talked about Matter of Trust, the Claremont. You get a similar beat in Paul Levitz and Paul Revoche's Hide and Seek, another one set very firmly in
Oh,
a
that was good.
in a very particular moment, because it references reclamation after the No Man's Land. But again, it's a good little Batman being a detective following a trail, but it also again ends with this moment of Batman might not be great with his kids, but he is good with kids. And the fact that he dedicates this rushed search from a train derailment, that when he rushes off, Gordon is like, oh, it must not be an accident. No, it was just after the accident, a kid stumbled away from the train and he needed to track him down to make sure he was all right, is really how my Batman works.
This is kind of a dark question, but Law and Order SVU got so much mileage out of pitting Detective Stabler against child predators and having him be super, super duper angry. Has any writer ever tried a Batman story like that?
There is a story, and it is on a prospective episode called Batman: The Ultimate Evil. Are you familiar with Andrew Vax?
Ooh,
VACCHS.
I feel like I should be, but that name is stirring something.
Vax was, I believe, a lawyer. Yes, he was a lawyer at one point before he became an author. And when, as a lawyer, worked with, as a front line with CPS. So his books thematically are about people investigating and dealing with child predators. And he wrote a Batman novel that was adapted into a two-issue comic book prestige format miniseries. It is very much not canon, but that is the one story that jumps to mind that is really about Batman and child predators actively. I
That
have.
animated series episode Underdwellers,
Yes.
and
Yep.
that gets at it, but in a very fictionalized kind of
Right.
way.
This is the most realistic way I can think of. I'm sure if I sat back and thought about it for more than 30 seconds, I would come up with other times that it's happened. But Ultimate Evil is the big one. And I have that with two other Batman sort of PSA real world issue comics that friend of WMQ and hopefully friend of this show in the not too distant future, Rob Lynch will come on and talk about, as Rob loves a good or not so good PSA comic.
A very special episode.
Yes. Rob likes to call them preachy treats.
Preachy treats.
Yep, but we will eventually cover that. I think we've touched on most of them at this point. The Steve Siegel, Daniel Torres fortunes was again just kind of there. I don't entirely know what Siegel was getting at in that story, putting Batman with this very devout Muslim detective. I don't quite know why
Now,
that was there.
was I insane, or did a very similar name or that name itself come up in one of the other stories tonight? Because I swear to God, I read that and I thought, oh, where else was that guy?
It was definitely not the same guy, but as we go, I'll see if it comes into my head, because didn't pick that up. But it also might have been me reading them in different order than you. The Ellison Lee is very pretty. The John Byrne is meh. It's John Byrne's usual golden silver age fanficiness. He loves to write stories set in those styles. Although this one is not as good as his other Batman one in that style, the Batman Captain America crossover. The Paul Pope is cool.
That was fun.
It's fun. It's not the most memorable, but it's fun.
Batman punches a guy in the nose because he can.
Yeah, not overly in love with that.
But hey, you break my nose, I'm gonna want to break your nose.
And the last one, the only other one we haven't talked about is the final one, The Bat No More from Alan Grant and Enrique Breccia. Cool to see some more Alan Grant. I mean, Lord knows we haven't enough Alan Grant on this list to begin with. Fun story, perfectly good. The Breccia art is very pretty. Perfectly in that middle tier of these kind of stories.
Absolutely.
But I think that we've covered all of them.
I think it's time to put story 400 on the big board.
Well, so if this is 400, then we obviously have 399 on the big board right now. Number one is the post-crisis origin of Batman, Batman Year One.
And still at a sexy 69 is JLA Prometheus.
At 100 is Made of Wood, the team up of Batman
Yeah.
and Alan Scott by Ed Brubaker and Patrick Zercher. Down at 200 is Nowhere Man, the Clayface story from Batman Volume 2 by Scott Snyder. At 300 is Haunted, a Legend of the Dark Knight digital first from Stephanie Phillips. And all the way at 399, we got War Crimes.
Nominative determinism holding down the bottom.
I think we're top 100.
And I think we are, I know this is going to be a shock, we are somewhere between the last volume that we covered, 78, and 10.
Yes, because this is above the third, which is good and has both some very good stories from some classic creators and some good introductory stories from newer creators. But I think the range there is wider.
It is. There are some Batman and the Bat are both better than the very worst from that volume.
Yes, exactly. Does this make 50? 50 is gothic. Grant Morrison, Klaus Janson, Batman fights a supernatural serial killer in the Year One era. I've got a real soft spot for that story, as it was my first exposure to Morrison. And the first time I think I read a comic where I like sat there and I pored over it and tried to pick out all the clues. But I don't know if that necessarily makes it better than this. It's a sentimental thing.
If it does make the top 50, it would be just barely, because I don't think I can put this above Golem of Gotham at 46.
I think it is somewhere in between 46 and 58, the first part of Eternal. I am, by the way, I looked at the second of these Gotham Knights collections. There is, I believe, at least one, if not two, Darwin Cooks in there. So we
Oh,
do
God
have some
damn.
more Darwin Cook Batman floating around that we haven't quite covered yet. So that made me happy. It's always tricky with an anthology because you look at some of these stories and they're just good stories. Where does the best story and the worst story in this average out to? Because the best stories in this are so high that they bring up those lower stories.
But there was really nothing problematic here.
No. The closest was a line in the Gibbons, but the Gibbons was so clearly written as if it were a story that had been written in the 1960s that using the phrase, and I cringe to even say it out loud, Chinamen is,
That was a little rough.
it was a little rough, but since the whole story was written in the parlance of the 60s, it's like, all right, I don't necessarily say you get a pass because we do have to call it out, but it was one line in an otherwise really solid story.
How do you feel, Mr. Tim Drake fan? How do you feel about this in relation to 51,
That's
Identity Crisis?
right where I was looking. I think we can narrow, I don't think this quite makes the top 50. This is in the somewhere in the 51 to 55. I think we can squeeze it even closer. I mean, Identity Crisis is a solid, fun Grant and Breyfogle story. It is the first appearance of Tim Drake in his Robin costume, but I don't think it ever quite hits the emotional punch that the best stories in here do. It is more important to canon, but when we're up at this point, we have stuff that is not as important to canon, but is just powerful.
The new 51, then?
The New 51. What was the last book we had above even 100? Final Crisis back a few months ago. Above 100 right now. We only have eight or nine stories above 100 that have appeared since episode 100. So this is a good showing.
Prometheus was stuck at 69 for quite a while.
Yeah.
And as a friend in real life and friend of the show, Will Crisp, mentioned to me a few weeks ago, tonight's episode means that I am not too far away from listing episode 420, or excuse me, book number 420. And I look forward to that.
That is very true. We are getting there.
And wheel children just. Talk to your dad about what 420 means and how everything has a time and place, and it's college. That's the answer, college.
Our second story of the night is Playground. This is Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, number 114. The writer is James Robinson, with pencils by Dan Barretin, inks by Tim Bradstreet, colors by Digital Chameleon, letters by Willie Schubert, and edited by Archie Goodwin. The cover date is January of 1999. Early in his career, Batman has pursued an assassin to Chicago, but did not count on the assassin getting the jump on him. Wounded, the Dark Knight wanders a barren and foreign landscape of the unhoused and mentally unwell, trying to stay alive while protecting others from the man trying to kill him.
The wastelands of Chicago.
Yeah. So this is very specifically set 18 months since he became Batman. He says that at the beginning of this story. So we have a very clear point in time here. I picked this one not remembering too much about it, other than it felt good for this kind of celebratory episode in that you love Dan Barretin, I love James Robinson. I don't know if this is the best from either of them. It's weird to see Barretta not painted.
Yeah, and you get his painted cover, and I just assumed that, oh, it's going to be Breton painting. No, he's in traditional pencils here.
Not bad.
No, of course not.
No, but not what I expect. Because again, I hadn't read this since January of 99, so it's since November of 98 when it was actually released. This is a better idea than the execution of it.
Yes, and I think certainly Robinson has his heart in the right place when it comes to dealing with the unhoused and talking about how basically people should care about them, but it does come off as very awkward in spots.
And the point that he makes at the very end of the story feels like it should have been something he was investigating for the entire story, and not just at the very end after the superhero plot has wrapped up. Batman going, this really is terrible that these people are living like this. I have the money to do something about it. I should do that.
I think it's better thematically if it's still just set in Gotham. I like Batman being out of his comfort zone, but if you're trying to write this with the idea of, oh, I'm just going to kind of like talk about the plight of the unhoused here, I think it's much more powerful of a story if it is Bruce in Gotham recognizing, oh, wow, I've kind of been too busy punching people in the face to really deal with this other stuff here. I should start taking care of this, right? This is still an issue in Gotham, regardless of it not being on the page in Gotham. So it's an odd choice to do this story set in Chicago. And I think it, again, it's more to remove him of his normal allies, take him out of his comfort zone, but that doesn't line up well with the main point.
I also think maybe it's putting him in a real city reinforces that this is a real problem versus if you set it in Gotham, it's like, oh, well, it's a fictitious city. So I don't have to think about this being a real thing because it's a problem in Gotham City. I think choosing a real city does reinforce the reality of the problem, but I absolutely agree it removes the aspect of Batman thinking that it is his problem. I guarantee you, a month does not go by where a new comic does not come out where Batman calls Gotham his city. So approaching that problem in Gotham would make it more about his culpability and or seeing the tent city for all intents and purposes that shows up at the end happens to be under the Solomon Wayne Bridge. Seeing his name right above where this is happening gives it more of an emotional punch.
Absolutely.
I do like a story set, especially earlier in Batman's career, where he is not just out of his element, but has clearly made a mistake.
Yes.
Because it reinforces that Batman isn't perfect. And there are enough stories that are written where I love Batman more than is probably healthy, but
How many episodes of a Batman podcast have you done?
how much money have I spent on Batman stuff? But I am personally pretty sick of the you give Batman enough time to prepare and he could beat God. No.
That's not fun.
Exactly. Batman has to struggle. He has to try. He can be super ultra prepared, but he's going to run into things that he's not prepared for. All of the plans that we see in Tower of Babel require him to not just have prepared the plans, but be ready when those heroes go rogue. If the Flash or Superman or Wonder Woman decided to go rogue and the first thing they thought of doing was, hey, let me kill Batman, Batman dies.
Yep.
And arguing that no, he's going to be prepared regardless is boring because it makes him superhuman. And one of the things about Batman that I like is the struggle.
Yeah, his superpower is not always being prepared. It's never giving up.
We've seen that in the Rom V run recently, that most recent issue of Detective as of when we're recording. All the inspirational things he says there are about you never surrender. You keep going. It's Batman Begins. Why do we fall? So we can learn to pick ourselves back up. That is the core of Batman.
He is Sisyphus. He is Prometheus. He's going to keep fucking that chicken.
Yes. So this story where it's like, okay, he thought he was, you know, just going to use surprise and fear and jump this hitman. And, oh, the hitman knew somebody was going to be coming for him. So he was just waiting. Batman gets gut shot and is now completely flat-footed, gives him that thing to fight against. If this were the Batman of the present or the Batman of any time after probably Robin, I would think that that was out of character because he would have learned to be more prepared. But a Batman of somewhere in between year one and year two, yeah, he's cocky SOB. He's used to being in Gotham where everyone knows who he is and everyone's afraid of him. This guy's not afraid. And it, again, a truism of Batman, it shows how much that fear that he inspires is important to the fact that he just doesn't get shot.
This is not a real complicated story. It's not anything more complex than Batman is shot and then stumbles through Chicago. And he meets various unhoused characters along the way who eventually help him at the end.
This story predates the first Spider-Man movie, but it has that moment from the end of Spider-Man that was so very post 9/11 New York, you know, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us. The line that now reads is really clunky, but this has that vibe to it. This is not a story, like there isn't even a full description of this on the DC Wiki. I wonder if there's literary allusions, Dante's Inferno, Circles of Hell kind of thing going on here.
You know, I was fairly sure that we were going to be reading this and talking about it. And this was going to be one of those things where, Matt, you were going to say like, oh, yeah, you know, he was trying to do this thing here. He was making this reference here. He was going for this genre here.
I think there is definitely something, because that's well within Robinson as a writer, but I didn't pick up the particular reference. One of the characters that he encounters is a guy calling himself Voltaire, who speaks only in quotations. If I had had more time, I would have Googled what all of those quotations were, because I'm sure there is some reference there. But I don't see the Dante of this. I've never read the Inferno completely. I've read excerpts, and I don't see this as an Inferno, but it feels like there's definitely something going on here underneath. It's Voltaire, who seems to be collecting books and living in a flop and speaking in quotes. It's a cop who lost his badge and is now a drunk on the streets. The Queen of Fleas, who is a Vietnam vet who now lives on the streets. And then a cardboard city. Not that it is not a problem now, because again, it remains a problem, very much so. But actually, this seems a little, no, because that was a big thing. Even then, the homeless vets was something that you're seeing a lot of in the late 90s. And then it came back as a major social issue around the time of people really starting to come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. But it felt very much a timely social issue to discuss. Our villain is very one note. Rhodes the Hitman is not anything special. He's just happens to be good at what he does and wears purple spandex and goggles. So it's not like he's a, you know, nattily dressed mob hitman.
I was looking around real quickly online to find maybe some annotations for this issue or some expanded thoughts. No, there's nothing.
This is a one-off Legends of the Dark Knight, two issues out from No Man's Land. This is not a comic that has been thought about terribly much. I might have to do some annotations myself and dig around and try to scan those quotes and figure out all the stuff that Robinson is quoting in that Voltaire sequence.
But I do know at least that Walt Simonson and Dan Barretton did a Legends of the World's Finest together.
Yes, they did. That's one to get to at some point when we do some more Batman Superman stories.
And this DC Wiki page for Barretton does not have six fingers.
Huh.
It's got Thrill Killer, this story, JLA Secret Files, and that's it.
There's a couple others. He did another JLA, a one shot called, I think, Seven Caskets.
Ah, that is listed here.
Okay. Batman's definitely in there because that's a Magnificent Seven story.
Oh, and there's Six Fingers, 100
Okay.
page, super spectacular.
That no one can seem to find.
It exists somewhere.
Exactly. Just gotta find it. I don't know if I have anything really else on this one.
Breton did a hell of a cover in his usual paints.
Yeah, and he does just the cover of the next issue as well. Another quick little one-off before it starts in No Man's Land the month after that. We'll cover that one someday, but no rush.
I suppose you would consider this the end of the good maybe run of Legends of the Dark Knight.
This ends the consistently good Legends of the Dark Knight, yes. Once it comes back from No Man's Land, there are still some very good arcs, but it is much more hit and miss.
Just couldn't have left it alone. Couldn't have left it alone as a special, separate, own little thing. All right. I think it's time to put Batman Legends of the Dark Knight number 114 Playground on the big board.
This is not as good as Blades, which is another Robinson. Blaze is at 228.
That's
Yeah.
injustice.
And I feel like we really need to choose a week to do the re-ranking. Because we need to just pick. I lean as we're gonna talk about, we're gonna say it right here. We're each gonna pick three stories that we feel like need to be re-ranked. We will do set a clock, 10 minutes discussion, 5 minutes to re-rank it. That is a 90-minute episode, and we will do that. And I will say flat out, Blades is one of my three.
All right, Matt, I think it's time. We need to do it. Let's get off our asses and let's do the draft right now. So your first pick is Blades.
Yes, this is gonna, and you know what? I will even say this. This is episode 150.
There you go. My goodness, you're making
It's, I
so many
mean,
plans.
it's still, that's still a ways off. That's still 16 weeks. That's still 4 months, but this is episode 150, is the re-ranking.
All right, I'm gonna go with Batman Judge Dredd.
Okay. My second is Holy Terror.
You know what? I'm gonna surprise you here. I'm gonna surprise you. Clown at Midnight.
Okay. Well, that takes away one of the ones that I was considering for my third slot. Okay, in that case, my third is 321, A Clash of Symbols, from way back in episode 7.
My goodness.
Yeah, I think we look at this, a lot of these are from very early. I mean, look at the Clash of Symbols is 7, Holy Terror is 3, yeah, Blades is 4. These are all in the first 10 episodes.
Oh.
And yet Judge Dredd was from 11 and
Yep.
Clown at Midnight was from 7. So you got one more.
Yeah.
This is what you get when we're doing the 400th story where we're making plans.
Yeah.
Or this will slot in as 150A because we want to keep the actual list divisible by the number of episodes. So this is a not as a bonus episode, but it is one that is not as numbered outside of the normal schema of the show, and it will air after episode 150. That's the way to do this. I'm gonna be cutting a lot of dead air.
I've made a big gamble saying that we should go ahead and pick these now, and I clearly wasn't ready.
I had a handful, and I knew you would go with Judgment on Gotham, so I knew I didn't need to worry about that one. Clash of Cymbals was probably going to be my pick regardless for that third slot, but you picking Clown at Midnight made it a lot more sure in my head that, yes, that's the one to do.
All right, I'm going to do you another solid. I'm going to do Batman in Bethlehem.
Oh, okay. So, yep. And that's the latest. I mean, that's episode 65. That's by far the latest. But that one with the context is going to matter so much more. But regardless of that, this whole came about because this is not better than Blades.
No.
And I don't actually don't think it would even why if even if Blades was up in the mid 100s versus 228, I still think this is a 200s book.
Yeah, because 200 is perfectly average now.
Yeah. And this is somewhere in the 250 is Batman in Bethlehem. So that's not exactly the best example because we think that one's going to be moving.
So there is more substance here than in Luther, You're Driving Me Sane at 277.
Yes, Luther, You're Driving Me Sane is fun, but it is not a substantive book.
This is better than Officer Down at 264.
Yes.
I might not put it above Joker's Boner at 260 or 258.
That's right about where I was looking. Yeah. I mean, below that is the highest Joe Kelly ranked story. Yes, the Batman and Wonder Woman viewing possible futures that they could live together story. Higher highs than this, lower lows than this.
We have 259.
Yeah, I could go for that. I could absolutely put that in here. A little above I Am a Gun, another Robinson. Our final story of the night is Original Sins. This is the Secret Origin Volume 2, Special Number 1. The writers are Neil Gaiman, Alan Grant, and Mark Verheiden, with pencils by Mike Hoffman, Sam Keith, Bernie Miraux, and Pat Broderick, inks by Kevin Nolan, Sam Keith, Matt Wagner, and Dick Giordano, colors by Tom McGraw and Joe Matt, letters by Todd Klein, Albert de Guzman, and Augustin Moss, and edited by Mark Wade. The cover date is October of 1989. When a sensationalist TV magazine show comes to Gotham, looking to profile its many costumed criminals, they do not heed Batman's warning that this will end poorly. As they interview some associates of villains, they grow ever closer to an unforgettable finale.
What a fun framing device here.
Yes. I really like the framing device. I like how Gaiman writes that. So Gaiman writes the frame and he writes the Riddler story.
No shock that they would be the highlights of the book.
Yep. Grant writes the Penguin story and Verheiden the Two-Face story. And I think each of those stories match pretty well with what we have come to expect from each of these creators and their standings on the big board. Because, you know, I mean, we've got Grant all over the joint and Gaiman stuff is real high. And the one Verheiden we have is all the way down to 313.
All the way down to 313.
He wrote that Superman Batman one with the Black Rock and the thing taking over aliens all around the Earth.
Yeah, this is not so good.
No, this is better than that.
Absolutely. The only thing that really puzzles me, really just hurts my brain, the game and stuff has all been remastered. It's been touched up, been cleaned up, looks nice and sharp. The rest of this looks like bad scans.
Because the Gaiman stuff has been reprinted in the DC stories of Neil Gaiman.
But how could you just reprint the framing device and not the stories?
I don't know. You reprint the framing device and the Riddler and you skip the other two. It's a really weird choice. But
That doesn't make any sense.
as we all know, DC collection department can make some weird choices sometimes.
Like, why would you do that?
I don't know. This framing device is perfectly of its time. Because this 1989, this is the height of Geraldo and Morton Downey Jr. And we're not in the Jerry Springer world yet, but
Yeah,
very
this is where they
much.
had to, this is where the daytime talk show people had to still try.
Yeah, this was when those shows would do these kind of hard copy. This is the era of,
Donahue.
yes, this is that kind of show was huge. Inside Edition. These were huge shows in the late 80s. Ask your parents, kids. And so to have this,
Going back to Morton Downey Jr., sorry.
no.
Did you watch the Tales from the Crypt episode where he basically played himself?
Yes.
That was good. That was good shit.
That absolutely was. This story, it's got, your sleazy journalist who's looking to make a sensational splash by coming to Gotham and interviewing all of the quote crazies and especially trying to get the Joker. And it's clearly set after Death in the Family, because there's the line about he hasn't even been seen since that whole UN fiasco. He might not even be alive. So we're in between Batman 428, where Joker dies or disappears, and 450, when he first really appears again. There are hints of
That's
him in
a tight
between.
little window.
Yeah, there are the hints of him in between in things like Lonely Place of Dying, where he's alive. But he's still not active again until 450, or, well, technically the end of this story. Great ending. Such a good ending.
It would probably be the only place where I would dare quibble with Neil Gaiman. Going to like the man on the street interviews. It's such a kind of a soft ending. But then, of course, you get the anchor journalist dying from Joker gas, right? I think it would have been much more shocking if you didn't have the milquetoast up there to blunt it.
I wonder how much of a cliche that was in 89. I wonder if that's an idea that's been done to death since then, and at that point felt more topical, because again, this was the kind of thing that was on TV every day. I also did like that you got a John Constantine cameo amongst those men on the streets. That was just a neat little one panel. Sorry, Squire, not from around here.
I'm looking back over because I missed it.
He's at the
Holy
bottom,
shit.
yeah, bottom of the first page. That is very much Constantine.
Well, look at that.
In my head, I rank these three, the three stories within Riddler, Penguin, Two-Face in that order.
Yeah, and it's a pretty tight grouping, right? I think the Riddler story is a good meta commentary on the Silver Age, the props and the how things used to be, you know? They were better then.
And Riddler was a character who was not really in use at this point. Crisis happened and he wasn't used. Denny O'Neil used him in one issue of The Question, where he gets released from Arkham and he decides to retire. And he winds up on a bus, which I can't remember the details. I think the bus is hijacked or something and runs afoul of The Question. And then he shows up here, and the next time isn't for another couple of years until Dark Knight, Dark City, which is a story we'll be covering with the return of Bruce Wayne, as it is the first appearance of Barbatos, although I don't think he's named that in Dark Knight, Dark City. At this point, he was sort of the retired villain. And I like the way they make him look here. He's got very much a receding hairline, and he looks a little bit older.
He does. And again, that's a conscious choice.
Bernie Murrow and Matt Wagner kill the art on this story. A lot of times, lots of little panels don't work, but here the movement of it really, really sings in this story. And Wagner, I don't know if this is before Murrow drew an arc of Grendel that Wagner wrote, but they would work together on the third major Grendel story, Devil Inside. So it was cool to see Murrow with Wagner inks here. There's some really good dialogue, some really good thoughts. It's set up from the beginning when they talk about the prop warehouse, because what Riddler is doing right now, retired, is he's the caretaker of the warehouse of all of the props, those giant typewriters and things that were all over Gotham. The talk show host observes, "I don't understand why anyone cares." And one of his producers observes to him that someone has to care. And that's the whole theme of this, is that we're in the point in 1989, this would have come out right around the release of Batman 89, which is obvious that why you're doing this triple-sized special featuring Batman villains is to capitalize on everybody coming to the comic book shops to get their Batman comics. But it's, I mean, it's talking to Year One, it's talking to Dark Knight, and Eddie just not moving with the times and being this relic. There's a great line, "The Joker's killing people for God's sake." You know, he remembers back when things were the way they were in 66. And it's a really thoughtful meta, as you said, it's a meta commentary on change and on the way comics had changed from the Silver Age to the mid to late 80s.
None of this stuff works anymore. They're all rusted up and forgotten. You know what they call them now? Camp, kitsch, corny, dumb, stupid. Well, I love them. They were part of my childhood. Back then, they all worked perfectly. The guns fired, the cameras took pictures, the pencil wrote. Nobody comes down here anymore. Nobody but me. Right? That is so Gaiman saying, I love these old stories. What's wrong with you people? They are still good.
That's him saying, you know, "I loved Batman 66. I grew up on Batman 66. People just say it's camp and kitsch now, but it's something that can be loved. And it takes a really impressive writer to write something that is so clearly meta commentary, but still make you care about the characters who are saying it.
Exactly.
And you care, you feel for Riddler in this story. You feel for him as this sort of sad, washed up shell of what he once was. Now, I'm curious, you have regularly pointed out that you dislike when your bat villains are whiny about their childhood traumas.
Yes.
How did the Penguin story here strike you in that way?
It was a lot of Penguin whining about, what happened to him as a kid, but the depths that he would go to get back at the guy again, right? So it's not enough that he, got tough and swole and was able to beat his ass. No, he had to get revenge at him for killing all the birds at the pet store.
And that is a more concrete trauma than just being made fun of. I think the fact that this guy went out of his way to kill every bird in the pet shop that Penguin spent his time at is a much more brutal trauma than just, "This guy made fun of me." Because I don't know about everyone else who's listening to this, but I was bullied.
Yeah.
And you know what? What's the greatest revenge is living well? I don't care. I'm not going to track down my bullies and exact revenge on them for just being bullies. And that is what we saw in some of these other stories, the Scarecrow story specifically. But here, this guy kind of went above and beyond when it came to Penguin. And so I was able to be more like, yeah, I can understand why you kind of want to get back at him. And he ran away. Penguin was never able to exact his revenge at that point for him killing the birds. So it's not like with Scarecrow, who had exacted revenge on the bullies back when he was in high school and then decides to just do it again. This was a wound that he had been nursing because he'd never gotten his revenge.
And he did get his money's worth, right? He gets to torture the guy.
He punched his teeth out back then, and the guy got metal teeth. We got to point out he's Sharky, so
Shark
Shark
Watch.
Watch. And on top of it, he takes his oxyacetylene umbrella and melts his teeth closed. This penguin is brutal. And Sam Keith, we've usually said that I don't particularly like a grotesque penguin, but. This isn't a completely grotesque penguin. He doesn't have flippers and fangs and things. But all of Keith's characters are strangely proportioned. So here it works that he looks a little odd. The constant quoting of Shakespeare, again, lines up with a version of the penguin I like where it's this affectation of look at how smart I am, let me rub in how smart I am, versus it being an organic thing that he does. It's I think we said it with Penguin Triumphant, or I use it. It's gauche. He is this obnoxious social climber. I also think it's funny that Sharky here ran off to Chicago. So this is the second Batman story of the night with Chicago references.
He's coming back to Gotham for his dad's funeral.
And Penguin drops him in a tiger pit. I mean, Batman gets him out, but still. This is a Penguin who very much matches that presentation we got in Penguin Triumphant. The swaggering ego and proving how much smarter he is than everyone else is very much right here and very clear. The Two-Face story is one, this is the only story, the only comic story where Harvey's wife is Grace and not Gilda. They took the Grace name for Batman the Animated Series as well, which is an odd thing, but it's the only place where she's not Gilda. This is also before, written before Batman Annual 14, Eye of the Beholder, which is the story that establishes all the stuff with Harvey's father. So this is trying to establish a different origin. I think there's some ideas in here that might have worked with a little more fleshing out, because the idea that what initially caused Harvey's mind to start splintering was that he had dedicated his life to the law. And allying himself with Batman proved that the law wasn't enough is not a bad idea, but I don't feel like it's enough to turn Harvey Apollo Dent into Two-Face.
Yeah, like there's a lot you have to do to get Harvey Dent to where he is in most kind of conceptions of Two-Face, right? He has to hate Batman, someone who had been an ally. He has to be real interested in stealing shit and committing crime, which is not what one typically does as a DA. So it's a heavy lift. And I think right, you do have some interesting ideas here, right? Maybe, he does realize that I should have been devoted to the law, right? And Batman is the reason all of this stuff went south. But then we still have to figure out, again, why he's so busy stealing stuff.
the sort of frame within a frame here of Grace's narrative, it plays into that mindset, in that it's basically Grace telling the story of how a few months ago a guy Harvey sent up the river before he became Two-Face got out and wanted to exact revenge for Harvey sending him away and not accepting a plea deal. And Harvey's reaction, or Two-Face's reaction, or whichever one's reaction, when he confronts him, is simply that that was the law and he wasn't going to just accept a plea deal. Plays into that strict view of the law. But this was probably 10 pages. Isn't enough to tease all of that out. It's not a, again, it's not a bad story, but it's definitely the weakest of the three. And I could have used a little more time. I mean, the end with Grace, saying, talking about how he's not like Joker and all the other lunatics, the good man is still underneath. We could have spent a little more time with all of that. But all in all, I mean, while the weakest of the three, not a bad story.
No, not at all.
And again, I think also the art, I think, works in exactly that same order. I think the Miro is the best art, then the Keith, and then the Pat Broderick here. Again, and the Pat Broderick is perfectly inoffensive superhero art. It's not as stylized or as interesting as either the Miro or the Keith, but it tells its story.
This has been restored so well. The parts that have been restored. Ugh.
But we can't hold
Just
that against it.
no. But it, again, I just don't understand how you would put two-thirds of this book into a trade and think that, oh, this is fine.
It is a strange, strange way of thinking.
Whoever made that decision, I want them to answer to me. Oh boy. We ready to do this thing?
I think we are.
Oh, that means it's time. But Secret Origins Special number one from 1989 on the big board. Top 100?
I think so. Yeah, because 100 right now is Batman versus Predator. You know what? I'm going to give you a number right here and right now.
Oh, damn.
I think this is the new number 100, because I think right above that, 99 right now is my beginning and my probable end, which is a sort of secret origin of Batman, but I think has a little more emotional heft than this does. And Batman versus Predator, very cool. But again, I think this is a more thoughtful story than Batman versus Predator. Obviously,
That
because
yes.
Batman versus Predator is not intended to be thoughtful. It's intended to be Batman fighting a Predator.
And right at this point, 100 is not bad. This area, right? Hush, Boo, 93, Thrill Killer at 96.
A Little Gotham at 94. Batman and Batman Reborn, the first Batman and Robin arc at 97, down
Lonely Place
to,
of Living at 109.
yeah, I mean, I think we could go down to one tw even 120. I think the top, like, even 120, 21, 22 are still all really good comics. And even the, I mean, and then below that, you're getting into good, but nah, hell, no, I'm wrong. I think even down to like 135 is all really strong. But yeah, are we good with that? The new 100?
Absolutely.
That is two books in the top 100 tonight. And that does indeed do it for tonight. Next week, it's a fun little exercise. Over on our Patreon bonus episodes, we've covered the animated adaptations of many of the stories we've covered for the big board. Next week, we're covering the comic adaptations of some of Batman's live action and animated adventures.
Ooh.
We'd like to thank our Patreon backers, Dan Grote, Josh Wheel, Mrs. Abigail Hartbaum, Asimov Fangirl, Tony Thornley,
Go Utes.
Sam Hopper, John Wickham, Robert Secundus,
Bobby Two Bucks.
Tim Rooney, Giorgio Sergioli, David Wheel, Alexander Wheel, Matt McThorne,
McThorny,
Dan Offer,
Barely Knew Her,
and Nate Rendell for their support. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music / Audible, Podbean, and on comicsxf.com, where new episodes drop every Thursday. You can support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/batchatwithmattandwill, where you can get shoutouts, bonus content, pick a story, and even come on the show.
And I still don't know what a goddamn Podbean is, but you can find me on Twitter at Will Nevin, because I'm never leaving there, but I'm leaving this show tonight. Good night, Huntsville.
And be sure to visit ComicsXF at comicsxf.com or ComicsXF on Blue Sky and Twitter for our Friday weekly roundup of new Bat books. For my other show, the ComicsXF Interview Podcast, where my longtime best friend Dan Grote and I interview comics creators, retailers, publishers, journalists, and other related tradespeople, as well as all the other stuff Will and I are writing. And stay safe out there, folks. Gotham is not a place to be after dark.